Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Carrie Skogberg Eastman is the author of Immigration, Examining the Facts. It's an exhaustively researched book that examines immigration debate from all sides. She joins us now in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Carrie, welcome back to In the Moment. I feel like our conversation with Senator Tapio covered a lot of ground that was maybe not about immigration or refugee resettlement, but that's what we're going to focus on with you. You were able to listen to some of the things that he said. And I'm wondering, what are some of the things that sort of stuck out to you as we, you know, have this open, honest, and sometimes difficult conversation about immigration and refugee resettlement in South Dakota? Where should we begin?
Well, I think we begin with the notion that South Dakotans need truthful evidence and facts to make informed decisions about how they feel about immigration and refugee resettlement. And that really is the basis for where we move forward from here to address what we may see as problems or to encapsulate what might be working well within the system. So really, my passion is for truths and factual, well-researched evidence to back up what we know, what we hear about, and how we converse about this topic.
I want to get into some of those, but first, for people who are listening, there's definitely an underlying theme that facts can be twisted, and people have an agenda. And so for the listeners of SDPB Radio right now are saying, well, I don't know if that fact is how do you approach it as a researcher to say this is how you get to the bottom of something and paint a full picture based on research and statistics and facts?
Right. The information in my book encapsulates thousands of resources that have all been proven as empirical sources of data. They are studies done by universities. They are nonprofit organizations who politically across the board have been accepted as well founded organizations such as the Pew Research Center, the Brookings Institution, places that have done decades of research on these topics and have based on that research, come up with the facts, statistics, empirical data that show us the direction and the trends that these issues are taking, including immigration.
All right. So where do you want to begin?
Well, I think I would like to begin by addressing some specific bits of information that I heard in the interview with Senator Tapio that I think need to be clarified. One of which is the fact that there is not any embargo of information regarding refugee resettlement in South Dakota. That information is public information. It can be accessed at the LSS website in terms of numbers, in terms of how refugees are resettled, what is the vetting process that they go through, etc. And in addition, that report from LSS that it encapsulates all that information and more is provided directly to the legislature. So our state lawmakers know exactly what's happening with the refugee system and where it's going, how many people are coming, where they're coming from, what their ages are, what their genders are, etc. Also information about how they are acclimated, how they are brought into this country, how they are educated when they get here, the kind of support that they receive from LSS and partner organizations that help them to become citizens that are contributors to the communities that they are resettled in, which in South Dakota are primarily Sioux Falls, with also some, there had been historically direct resettlement in Huron that ended in 2016, but there are still some family members who eventually join previous refugees who had resettled in Huron, and there are some who also have migrated to Aberdeen for jobs in that area as well. So that information is out there. It isn't hidden. The director of Lutheran Social Services has said publicly that this is information that is the public can access it easily, and that they aim to be very transparent with whatever they're doing. In fact, it was the state in 2000 that requested that Lutheran Social Services assume the oversight of the refugee resettlement program. So it was at the state request that LSS be the director of this program.
All right. And if someone from Lutheran Social Services is listening, you're certainly welcome to come on the program. We'll reach out after the show today and bring them in to sort of talk about some of these reports and that information so people can continue to get that full picture. Other highlights?
I think another highlight is in the numbers. Indeed, the number of refugees resettled in the state of South Dakota has decreased over the past 5 years, with this past year being the lowest number ever, or in recent history anyway. In 2013, there were 535 refugees resettled here. 536 in 2014. That dropped to 495 in 2015. There were 439 in 2016 and 316 in 2017. So Senator Tapio talked about the notion of chain migration and bringing family members here, but it's really important to understand the process that these refugees go through when they come to the United States. They are not automatically U.S. citizens. In fact, they arrive with only temporary residency, and they have to apply for legal permanent residency after being in the United States for 1 year, and they must go through that process and be approved in order to be legal permanent residents. If they are approved for that, after 5 years, the legal permanent residents may then apply for U.S. citizenship. And so if they go through that process and are approved as U.S. citizenship, as U.S. citizens, and they want to try to sponsor family members to come, those family members are subject to the same annual caps and limits per country. They are subject to the same vetting process that any other immigrant would go through to come to the United States. Or if they were to come as refugees, they would go through the same process that their family member refugees had gone through to come to the United States, which is a very, very vigorous process, and it's a very small percentage of all refugees that are ever admitted into the United States. And I'd like to talk about that in just a moment, too. So the notion of chain migration really isn't accurate when we're talking about refugee resettlement, because it would be years and years down the line before they would even be eligible to apply for family members to come. And just to give you an idea of the current wait times, I'll give the examples of Mexico and the Philippines right now, because those are two of the more extreme countries. But if you are applying for a brother or a sister to come to the United States and you're from Mexico or from the Philippines, the current wait time is 22 to 23 years.
Wow.
So it is not a quick or an easy process. And again, those people are subject to all of the stringent requirements and the vetting processes that any other immigrant is required to go through who comes to the United States. And that brings up another point. It was mentioned that the diversity visa program does not vet immigrants, that they are just selected and brought to the United States. That is not true as well. Those immigrants are vetted just like any other immigrants. And if there is any kind of criminal background, any terrorist activity, anything in their background that would arouse suspicion, they are not allowed into the United States either. They must go through a very, very thorough vetting process in order to be admitted. Now, I'd like to touch on what it means for a refugee to go through that process and be admitted to the United States. The number of refugees brought into the United States is very small, and let's just talk about worldwide. There are right now approximately 21 to 22 million refugees in the world, and about a total of 439 refugees were resettled in South Dakota among that population in 2016, and 316 of those in 2017. So it is a fraction of the number of worldwide refugees, that are admitted into the United States in the first place as resettled refugees, and B, that are brought to South Dakota. But the process to get them there, the reason that there are so few is because the process is so rigorous. And this is a really important point that listeners would want to understand, that it's not simple to be designated as a refugee. These are people who are fleeing a situation in their home country, and they are designated as official refugees by the United Nations after going through an interview process because they fear returning home based on their race, religion, nationality, membership in a political group, or membership in a cultural group. So, based on one of those five factors, they feel they cannot return home. Most often they go to country B, where a large majority of them end up in refugee camps. Okay, so they must register with the United Nations to even be designated as a refugee and go through an interview with the United Nations. If they are granted that refugee status, then they can receive referral for resettlement in the United States. But only the most vulnerable people are referred, accounting for less than 1% of refugees worldwide. So of that 21 to 22 million number of refugees in the world, less than 1% are ever resettled into a third country. The rest of them remain in refugee camps, or if they are lucky enough to be able to return home, will eventually return home. But most just have a temporary status or a non-legal status in a secondary country. So if they receive a referral for resettlement here to the United States, they then must go through an interview with the State Department. They do a background check, and then there's a higher level background check for some. If they come from a certain country that might arouse suspicion, then there's a higher level background check. And again, a third background check, which was introduced in 2008 for Iraqis, but now has been expanded to all refugees ages 14 to 65. Next, they go through a first fingerprint screening and their photo is taken. Then they go through a second fingerprint screening and a third fingerprint screening. And those fingerprints are screened against FBI databases, Homeland Security databases, and also databases through the U.S. Defense Department. Next, their case is reviewed at a U.S. immigration headquarters. And some cases are referred for an additional review, particularly among Syrian refugees, because there has been concern that there isn't enough information and background on some of those refugees. So they go through two additional steps of referral and case review. Next, an extensive in-person interview with a Homeland Security officer is conducted, again, particularly for Syrian refugees. Homeland Security approval is required for the process to continue. Next, they go through screening for contagious diseases. After that, cultural orientation classes. After that, they can be matched with an American or they're not all resettled here, with any other resettlement agency in the receiving country. After that, a multi-agency security check is done again before they can leave for the United States. And that's because it takes so much time to go through all these screenings and background checks, up to 2 years to do all of this vetting and information gathering, that they do one additional screening right before they leave. And finally, when they arrive at an American airport, they go through another security check and screening there. So it is not a quick or easy process. It's not something that is handed out to anyone who wants to come here. It's a very difficult and time-consuming process to be approved to come to the United States as a refugee.
If you're just tuning in, this is just one of many conversations we're going to be having in the months ahead on In the Moment about refugee resettlement, about immigration, and about issues of faith, because some of those are connected in some people's minds. So stay tuned for that. If you have ideas for more that you want to hear, In the Moment at sdpb.org is my email address. Send us your thoughts on conversations today. You can listen to everything again at listen.sdpb.org. Carrie, I know I have to interrupt you too and cut you off as well, like I did Senator Tapio, and I actually gave him a little more time than I was able to give you. But I'm wondering if you could close with this notion of one of the first things Senator Tapio said people are concerned about and are coming and talking to him about is crime. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk about immigration, refugee status as it relates to crime statistics.
I would be happy to. Yes. Yeah. Again, I want to reiterate that no group is vetted more thoroughly than refugees. And so crime rates among refugees who are coming here are historically incredibly low because they've already gone through so many security and background checks. Among immigrants in general, study after study after study over decades of research have all pointed to the conclusion that immigrants have lower crime rates than native-born American citizens. That's not just one study or two studies. It's not partisan studies. These are across the board. Studies have shown that immigrants have lower crime rates than native-born Americans, particularly in the categories of violent crime and property crime. Now, where some of the rhetoric starts to arise regarding crime rates, people will say that the jails are filled with immigrants or foreign nationals. What's important to consider in those arguments is that often the crime that they have been associated with or that they have committed was crossing a border. So among those who are considered criminals, the crime may be crossing a border. But the crime rates still overall are lower among immigrants than they are among native-born Americans. That changes by the third generation. Of course, by the third generation, these are U.S. citizens, and they have assimilated so well that their crime rate actually rises to the level of native-born U.S. Citizens. But studies, the researchers have shown that in immigrant-heavy neighborhoods, in larger cities in particular, they've attributed immigrants with a decrease in violent crime because it seems that in those areas, there's perhaps less incentive among people who are looking to try to achieve U.S. citizenship or people who are coming here to build a better life. The reasons are speculative, but the facts and the statistics and the numbers show that the rates are lower in communities where immigrants form a larger percentage of the population.